just comments. Welcome to the Non-Gaussianity workshop. It's lovely to have you here. Thank you for inviting me to co-organize the workshop. We've tried to be very generous with the time for every talk, so there should be a lot of opportunity for people to ask questions and for discussion. The coffee break after the session is pretty long, and that was intentional. I hope that we can get good discussion going, and that hopefully this workshop will also help us to define what I think will be an exciting program for the next years ahead in looking at non-Gaussianity as a probe of the early universe and the physics of the beginning. So to make some start really at the beginning, why are we even interested in cosmology? So it's because it's about big questions. We like big questions. For example, what is the fundamental theory valid at the highest energies? Or what happened at t equals zero? Those are big questions that are exciting to at least those of us who choose cosmology as their field of employ. And taking a nice visual image of the big picture of the universe from the WMAP publicity materials, I should have put a question mark next to inflation, given the very interesting talks that we've had for the last few days in the Novel Frontiers, Novel Theory workshop, Novel Theories of the Early Universe. Not because inflation was questioned there, just because there are interesting alternatives to inflation that were discussed. But the big picture is that we have our universe to look at. We are lucky to have a baby picture of the universe, the ultimate time capsule, looking at the cosmic microwave background as it was emitted when the universe was around 380,000 years old. And our interpretation of this cosmic microwave background is that it is essentially an image of the quantum fluctuations in the early universe created when the universe started. For example, in the theory of inflation or in the ekpyrotic model, in both of those cases, we are looking at an image of the quantum fluctuations created curvature perturbations as the universe emerged from the epoch of quantum gravity. All right, so how do we study what happens at the highest energy scales and the shortest time scales? You can construct a showdown between particle physics on the one end and astronomy on the other end, where you have CERN, of course, and LHC switching on this year. And on the other end, HST looking deep into the universe and studying the early epochs of galaxy formation and structure in the universe, as well as WMAP and Planck. And Planck is scheduled to launch later this year. I don't know if it's going to happen at exactly the same time, but it's a very interesting I wouldn't say coincidence, but it's I think for the next few years, for the years going years ahead, having both LHC and Planck pushing at the frontier will be extremely exciting for cosmology and for this program. Okay, so what about will accelerators work? Will they tell us everything we need to know about the early universe, what we want to know? And the answer is, of course, no. There's a hard technological limit. We just will not be able to go much farther, many orders of magnitude higher in energy compared to where we are currently with, or where we will be with the LHC. So the goal is, as we push towards the realm of quantum gravity, is to use astronomical observations and interpret them and milk them for their cosmological information. And here's an example of that. Did the animation work? That was supposed to be an animation of, it's just flickers, I don't know. It's too fast. this is in real time, inflation. Forgot to slow it down for the presentation. Essentially seeing a smooth background where perturbations are seeded through quantum fluctuations as inflation happens, in a similar mechanism, just sort of in reverse, so a dual mechanism almost for the ekpyrotic universe. So then gravity, of course, acts on these density perturbations and makes them larger, and they collapse, and they form galaxies and planets and people and all that. Okay, so what are the data? Well, we know that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. That gives us a background that we can work with. We know the universe is close to flat from a combination of data sets. And we have a view of these seed perturbations in the cosmic microwave background, also through galaxy surveys. But I will focus on the cosmic microwave background. And the Nobel Prizes have started coming in, so that's good. Let's keep it that way. So if we focus on inflation for the moment, how do we go and test the inflationary paradigm? There are various probes of inflation. Since inflation generates the primordial fluctuations in space-time, we can look at the imprint of that of those perturbations in radiation. There's temperature perturbations and polarization perturbations and anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. We look at fluctuations in the matter through the dark matter distribution, gravitational lensing, for example, galaxy and gas distribution through redshift surveys, Lyman alpha surveys, cosmological 21 centimeter radiation, which is an exciting but futuristic technique. It's futuristic at this point, hopefully not for much longer. And then we can look at fluctuations in space-time itself through trying to detect primordial gravity waves, essentially the reverberations of space-time from the Big Bang. Okay, so how do we go about doing that? Well, so the zeroth-order test, zeroth-order tests of inflation are, is the observable universe flat? I think that is recognized to be a robust, if not completely necessary, prediction of inflation. Are the fluctuations nearly Gaussian? Are the fluctuations nearly scale independent or scale invariant? And are the fluctuations adiabatic? Those are the main questions we want to ask testing inflation. And I know that many of you have ideas in your heads of how to modify inflation to make one or break one or another of these assumptions. I guess I should have also included in this list an assumption about the initial state, whether you're starting in the Bunch-Davies vacuum or not. Clearly, you can make exotic inflation models that violate any one of these assumptions, but I think at zeroth order, when we talk about canonical, slow roll, single field inflation, that's what we mean. Right. This is what we learned. This is what I grew up with, and it's going to be taught in high school soon. All right. Okay. So, yeah.
I shouldn't be taught. Okay. High school.
All right. It's the one time in this talk when I didn't mention ekphorosis when I said judge. Right. So there are of course alternatives. However, even in those cases. All of these actually still go through in the observations. We would expect, even for the ekphorotic model, we would expect a flat universe with nearly Gaussian perturbations that are nearly scale independent and nearly adiabatic. All right, so let's. So whenever I say inflation, you may just as well read ekphorosis actually for this talk, because we're testing the same tests, I think, are important for both of those paradigms. All right, so let's just assume that we found the universe is flat, homogeneous, and isotropic. I think that's true to good accuracy. When you combine HST data with WMAP, you get a very tight constraint on flatness, and it's consistent with flat. The seed perturbations are also nearly adiabatic. The most recent WMAP cosmology paper has actually an assessment of that, so it looks. It looks like that is also okay. Nearly scale invariant, again, much has been written about that, and the most recent WMAP results that Aitor will be talking about after this talk, and has talked about earlier already in the week, are consistent with a nearly scale invariant spectrum, and even give a hint that it that NS is less than one slightly. Okay, which is what we would expect. Okay, so But do we expect the primordial perturbations to be absolutely positively Gaussian? And the Gaussianity is what I will focus on, obviously, for this talk, and that we will be focusing on for the next few days. Actually, no, right? Different inflationary models predict different amounts of non-Gaussianity. So detecting or constraining non-Gaussianity helps distinguishing them. Of course, even if the primordial perturbations were completely Gaussian, we would still expect non-Gaussianities to come in just at the second order gravitational perturbation level. And GR produces non-Gaussianity from even completely Gaussian initial conditions. And in terms of FNL, which I'll define in a minute, that is expected to be of order one. So here's just a short overview of the kinds of levels of non-Gaussianity parameterized by this nonlinear parameter, FNL, nonlinearity parameter, that you would expect in different kinds of models of the early universe, including ekpyrotic models, the most recent estimates. So let me just take a step back and say that I think non-Gaussianity is a new frontier. This is why I'm excited about this meeting. Other than the information that you can gain from two-point correlations, which is substantial, non-Gaussianity opens a new window on the physics of the beginning. And you can imagine a program for the next few years and in the future to reliably predict the theoretical non-Gaussianity seen in particular models of the early universe, to characterize non-Gaussianity that we would expect from secondary anisotropies, gravitational effects, local foregrounds as we try to observe the cosmic microwave background and so forth, and then develop efficient and also practical statistical estimators that allow us to constrain, to draw inferences about non-Gaussianity from the data, taking into account both the features of the particular models and also the non-Gaussianity from secondaries and foregrounds and all the various confusion effects that come in. And that program has started. I will describe our push at this frontier that we've, that I'll do that in several steps. I will tell you how I think one should be searching for primordial non-Gaussianity, not just I, others also. But in general, how one should search for primordial non-Gaussianity, then describe some of the estimators that we're using, what we find, and how to interpret our result, and say a little bit about future prospects as well and conclude. Okay, so how to search for weak primordial non, let's also say non-Gaussianity. Okay, so what you do is you just take the data, you reconstruct the primordial curvature perturbations from the data because that's what you're interested in. You want to look for primordial non-Gaussianity. Then you test for non-Gaussian features. You compute the error bars using Gaussian Monte Carlo simulations because that's the null hypothesis you're comparing with. For weak primordial non-Gaussianity, you can even use those Gaussian Monte Carlo simulations to characterize the error bars on your the confidence intervals on your estimator. So here's how you reconstruct the primordial perturbations. You take data, like the cosmic microwave background data, this is a simulation, and apply a filter that essentially inverts the radiative transport from the very early universe when the quantum perturbations were laid down to the cosmic microwave, to when the cosmic microwave background was emitted and we receive it. I will show this in more detail in a minute, but this is this filter function. You see it oscillates around zero. This is because of the plasma oscillations in the early universe. You can actually invert the sign depending on scale of the perturbations that we're looking at. And this is how you construct the, this filter. Okay, so the point I want to drive home is that, and some people were a little skeptical about this when I first talked about this, but I think now most people have come around to this, is that these curvature perturbations leave a unique signature in the temperature and polarization data. It's really quite a unique signature that makes it difficult, actually, to confuse this with, at the signal-to-noise level of WMAP, makes it difficult to confuse the primordial signal with foregrounds or secondary anisotropies. And this particular signature, you can see here, corresponds to oscillations. Let's see, is there a point? Actually, I have a point. Okay, I'll use this one. Well, actually, low tech works better. Hockey stick. Okay, so these oscillations, you can see this is about an L of 50. These different crossover scales correspond to different slices of the surface of last scattering. Okay, you can reconstruct the curvature perturbations in different slices of the surface of last scattering given the data. And you see that there's this oscillating feature, which is very unique and is just based on physics of the primordial plasma. A very interesting feature for those of you who may be involved in polarization missions or for those of us who are working on Planck data and looking forward to Planck polarization data is that the polarization signal is completely out of phase with the temperature signal. So it really the polarization really provides a complementary probe of the primordial perturbations, and that allows for cross checks. Yeah. This is the filter that we derive for taking the temperature data and turning it into a best estimate of the curvature perturbation on a slice at a given co-moving distance.
This is for particular distance r. So this slice, and so in that slice, we use the information of temperature to reconstruct the curvature perturbation. Slice through the curvature perturbation. This is the optimal filter in L as a function of L that you would apply. So here, at large scales, for example, you see that it is -3. Which is exactly the one-third that you knew of when you translate the curvature perturbations into the temperature fluctuations. So minus one-third is to -3 when you do the inversion. But then this is a generalization of that number into a scale-dependent function, which tells you how to do that for each individual scale L. Yes?
Okay, so that's what you apply to the temperature power spectrum?
No, to the temperature map. So this is a filter that you apply to the map to get a map including the phases, which are important for the bispectrum measurement.
So why, I guess I would imagine that you would have three oscillatory from the oscillation. Why do you have that sort of flat feature on the peak and the sharp thing?
These features here?
Yeah.
I guess this is just because, I don't know, actually I haven't looked at the detailed shape of this, but I'm guessing it's just because the different contributions to the temperature, they're actually, you can split it up, it's a bit gauge dependent on how you split it up, but there's a Doppler contribution, there's an intrinsic acoustic oscillation contribution, and it just turns out that at different slices, different scales have gone through a different amount of oscillation, and that's basically what you see, it's why they shift around this way.
And so different slices.
Yeah, different slices.
So they may look different features with slices slightly different.
Yes, that's right.
Shouldn't really.
These slices here span a larger depth than the actual surface of last scattering. So it goes from basically before last scattering to after last scattering and samples to variation across that.
You're basically reconstructing the potential within the sound horizon. So what you really care about is the phase of the perturbation when it gets to the surface of last scattering.
That's
so that's what explains all the features there.
Mm-hmm. The reason why you get these oscillations and why they're visible in the power spectrum is because they're in phase when they come into the horizon and they start oscillating. And then depending on what the time is, a particular K mode will have oscillated a certain number of times, and the oscillation makes it positive or negative, which is why when you look from large to smaller scales, you see basically different numbers of oscillations that occur. So this is why it oscillates. And when you map that, of course, here we're looking at L, not K, so that there's a sort of convolution of that, which is why this isn't what you would expect. You said you would expect just a completely nice, smooth oscillation.
Yeah,
so these slight differences from the sine wave basically come from the convolution of K that you do when you go from K to L.
So does this depend on the noise in or not?
I'm sorry. Make sure this doesn't switch off.
Do these filters depend on the noise, or just for the final cosmology? I mean,
what I showed you actually depends on the noise because it includes the divides by the autocorrelation, signal autocorrelation in the.
So if you sense a noise, that changes.
Right. Okay. It's so the noise suppresses this at high L.
Okay.
Because if you're noisy, then you just don't. So basically, what this shows you is that there are some scales for temperature. It's another comment I could make. For some here for temperature, at some scales, you set a particular slice. You cannot reconstruct the primordial perturbation at that scale, simply because the phase of that perturbation is crossed through zero. And so it's just blind to that particular scale. But if you look at different slices, you do get it. And then you see if you take the polarization, it actually is out of phase, so you complete the fairly complete picture. So here's a way of showing you this. So here's the map. Simulated map that is applied, where it applied this filter for temperature data alone. So what you see is you get information on large scales, and then there's some small scale information on top of that, which makes it appear really crinkly. And then when you include polarization, then you fill in the scales. Okay, you get intermediate scales, and you're not blind anymore to particular scales. So this is a slice of primordial curvature perturbation reconstructed from temperature and simulated temperature and polarization information. Still don't be happy.
Okay, you can ask me later. All right, so here's a little movie here. I don't know if you noticed this. I can do it again. So this is actually for different slices. Did you do it now? Oh, pressed too many times. Well, here it is again. Let me go back. Okay. So here's a little movie, actually, of the of these different slices and what you can see in these different slices as you do this, as you reconstruct the primordial curvature perturbation from temperature and polarization. And here's essentially a measure of how much information you have at different distances. So this is the last scattering surface here. Okay, so to summarize the first answer to the first question, how do you look for primordial non-Gaussianities? Well, first of all, you tomographically reconstruct the inflationary scalar curvature perturbation, which you can do in these slices. So anybody who writes non-Gaussianity paper analysis papers and wants to find primordial non-Gaussianities ought to be doing this, because not just because it enhances your sensitivity, because you're constructing an optimal filter, but also because you get the benefit of this particular signature, this oscillation in k-space, which is what you wouldn't expect that from foregrounds or other secondary anisotropies. So how to look for FNL? If you take a particular model, so the nice feature about looking for FNL is that you have a particular model that you can try to constrain, which is this, which is a nonlinear potential that you get by having Gaussian perturbations and then adding the square of those Gaussian perturbations, the local square, so the pointwise square of that perturbation times the factor FNL. And the prediction for that number, actually, I think this is the this was the FNL equilateral, which is a different type of FNL. But this is the local FNL that I will be talking about. And so the impact of that model on the bispectrum was worked out in this very nice paper by Komatsu and Spergel in 2001. So here's what that looks like as a map. So here's a Gaussian map, completely Gaussian map. Here's a Gaussian map with an FNL of 10. You see no difference. So I didn't see any difference. Here's an FNL of 100. I still didn't see any difference. Here's an FNL of 1,000. If you have really good eyes, you see a slight change. And here's an FNL of 10,000, which shows a really, really strongly visible signal. What you notice is that this signal corresponds to there are basically large but local negative peaks and sort of the hot areas are for more planar, if I can use that word to describe the morphology of this map. And roughly speaking, it's true, at least on large scales, large FNL produces a negative skewness. That's the way this goes. All right, so why use the bispectrum? So why do we look for this in the bispectrum? Well, actually, I want to advertise a talk which will be tomorrow by Franz Elsner, who is going to look for FNL using a fully Bayesian technique which doesn't go via the bispectrum. But the reason why the bispectrum is a really good way of looking for FNL is that there is no Gaussian contribution to it. So if you see any statistically significant FNL, it has to be from a non-Gaussian contribution. The next higher order moment is the trispectrum, and there is a Gaussian contribution. So if you look for a trispectrum, you have to first disentangle it from the intrinsic Gaussian contribution. So any even moment really is disfavored, which leads you to looking at odd moments, and the bispectrum is the lowest order odd moment. That's one argument, and then Dan Babich actually wrote a very nice paper where he showed that the bispectrum contains nearly all the information for weak non-Gaussianity. The bispectrum contains nearly all the information about FNL. In Kogo and Komatsu, there's an analysis of that that agrees with this statement, but shows that the trispectrum contains complementary information, not more information, but if non-Gaussianity is large enough, the trispectrum can actually give you another view of the non-Gaussianity as well. Unfortunately, evaluating all these bispectrum triangles, all these coefficients, is too expensive. So a number of papers have been written on how to actually do this. I'm not going to go through each one of those individually. Basically, after Eichiro's and David's paper in 2001, we looked at COBE, found a constraint. Then we developed a fast estimator that would allow doing this analysis for high-resolution experiments like WMAP or Planck, and I will talk about. And then there was, I think, a very nice paper. Let's see. It was realized that polarization would add a lot of information. And so then we also generalized the fast estimator to include polarization. A very nice modification that I will only mention very briefly is that by complicating the estimator slightly, you can produce a large gain in sensitivity by adding not just a cubic term, but adding a linear term, which has zero mean, but it's anti-correlated with the cubic term, which produces a reduction in the variance. So that was this paper here. And this is the tomography paper that I described in my introductory slides. And then eventually we applied this estimator to WMAP. Okay. What is this fast estimator? Well, so in Komatsu-Spergel and Landert, we realized that a very simple pixel-wise cubic combination of two filtered maps. Here's the primordial curvature perturbation. I don't know why it screwed up the placement of this, but this says primordial curvature perturbation. This is the reconstruction I showed you before. And you square that pixel-wise, and you just multiply then with another filtered map, which is designed to select exactly the bispectrum configurations that are affected by FNL and give you the optimal weighting. And then you integrate over the sphere, and you do that for all the slices in the reconstruction where you have any information, and that gives you a number that is actually proportional to FNL. So that this means that you can do the analysis. Yeah.
Local in, yeah, right, this is just a local integral.
It turns out that when you do this, when you actually put this together and you take the expectation value, then you get exactly the bispectrum, the theoretical bispectrum that you get from the.
Does it have something to do with the fact that you're assuming local non-Gaussian?
Yeah, this is absolutely related to the fact that
it's local. Okay, so if it wasn't, then it wouldn't be a local.
No, this will be, that's right. So this estimator works for a local
Yeah, for the natural, it can do the same thing, but it's much more complicated.
Right.
So it's not one, it's more than one integral, or is
it still? There are more terms.
More terms. Huh.
So this is a direct consequence of the fact that it's local.
Okay, so what is the status of, so this has been measured in the first year data and in the third year data of WMAP. then this nice modification, including this linear term, produced an improvement in the estimator, which was the best version of this until December 2007. Is again the list of models to compare with, and the error bar was roughly 35 at that point. I want to make a comment on this linear term. Sorry about the these overlaps. But so this linear term, which was introduced by Carminelli et al., here's actually what it is. You see it's linear in the data. Here's this filtered map again. And these are weight maps that can be computed using Monte Carlo averages. And they allow you to deal with these anisotropic noise distributions. This is actually a simulation for Planck, of the Planck noise distribution. So the way this works is that this term here has zero mean, because clearly the map of anisotropies has zero mean. But its variance, it's actually anticorrelated with the bispectrum. And so when you add it to the bispectrum-based estimator, the fluctuations cancel and you get a reduced variance. It's a good, actually a good idea. If you do Monte Carlo simulations, you may have heard about this. It's a standard method in doing Monte Carlo simulations where you want to reduce your variance. You define a second estimator that has zero mean and doesn't bias your results, but you make it anticorrelate with your first estimator and you get a reduced Monte Carlo variance. It's a nice trick for Monte Carlo simulations. And this is, it works in this context as well. We generalized this estimator to polarization. As we did that, we discovered there was a calculational error in the derivation, which we fixed. Again, things are slightly shifted here. But so here's an image of the error on FNL as you increase the maximum L you include in the analysis. This is the predicted Kramer-Rau bound. And these are, this is what you get with the KSW estimator without the linear term. This is when you added the linear term according to Carminelli et al. You see that there was a clearly identified point, a minimum variance point, beyond which the variance blew up with both of those estimators. When we corrected this linear term, it turned out that we could actually reduce the variance from about 40 or so to about 15 or so. Actually, this is the exact number here is not important. This is actually for a Planck simulation of a particular Planck channel. So it just shows that as you fix the this linear term, you get a reduction in the variance. This is the normalization factor of the linear term, and this is ours, and this is the previous one.
It is. This is shifted over, just like for some reason.
Everything's
so, shifted over. So, So here's ours, and this is the. Sorry about that. Oh, and
this is actually the V plus W band analysis simulation. This is Monte Carlo simulations for V plus W band, same axes. Actually, I should tell you, this is 30 here. That's 30. And you see that basically with this corrected estimator, you get a constant FNL standard deviation out to the largest L that you would want to include with WMAP. It's still slightly higher than what you would get from the Fisher matrix analysis, but it's not completely optimal, but nearly optimal.
We're just trying to decide if it was a stupid to ask, but can you explain a little bit better what that bound is? That
Let me just show this. some of these things moved. I did move this off again. I can see better. This is more like what it was supposed to look like. Okay, so here is the standard deviation on the FNL estimator. This is V plus W band. These are our Monte Carlo simulations. This is 30. Okay, right here. And you can see that the error bar within the Monte Carlo error, the error bar actually converges as you include more and more data.
That's just because the variance keeps on getting.
So compared to this, where the variance actually flew off, the not are the corrected linear term.
So that's
slightly suboptimal compared to the Fisher matrix based chromorial bound.
So you're not confusing yourself. By adding more data, you're not confusing yourself and making it worse.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So then you have to make a decision about whether you stop here or whether you stop there or there. And that unfortunately adds some ambiguity. And maybe I can comment on this now, but the reason, so we decided that because we have the ability now, we can just include all of the data rather than making an artificial cut.
So Ben, is this saying the KSW estimate is a biased estimate?
No, it's a suboptimal. This is a statement about the variance, not about the mean of the estimator.
Oh, I see.
For anisotropic noises.
In that you have noise and cosmic variance and everything.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. If you didn't have noise and only cosmic variance, how would the error go as a function of L max?
I don't actually have a plot of that.
It
keeps dropping.
Does it keep dropping or
one of our
L max.
Okay.
And eventually you actually run out of, well, if you really had cosmic variance all the way, it would speed up.
And the total signal to noise square should just scale like the number of pixels in your map. Mm-hmm. Right, so the signal to noise of the error bar is going to scale like 1 over the square root of that, or 1 over L max.
Okay. Well, let's talk later on.
Yeah, I actually have an image of that, okay. Not from Monte Carlo simulations, but from Fisher matrix estimate. You may actually see that.
Yeah, because I did a quick back on the envelope calculation of how the noise would scale as a function of the max. Huh. And I was getting that it was dropping very rapidly, and then sort of dropping, but much, much less rapidly. So I was wondering, would you kill yourself to go to L of 900 if you don't gain that much? But apparently,
Ben, can I follow up quickly?
Sure.
So is this correction data dependent? Like, is it mass dependent? I mean, is this correction universal? Like,
the correction is so these weight maps change if you change if you change the instrument, if you change the noise, if you change the mask. So
you had to agree Monte Carlo again for every experiment.
So that's actually another point. I thought I would make a slide of it, but then I decided to get to it because it's a small point for a slide. But every one of the numbers you're going to see requires doing a large Monte Carlo simulation. This is the same for HO's analysis. So you know, every single number that you see requires Monte Carlo. It's not just one calculation. It's actually a Monte Carlo simulation. It's a large Monte Carlo simulation to compute the weight maps, which you then use to define the estimator, which you then use to apply the data. And then you Monte Carlo that to get the error bars. So there's a lot of computation involved for each one of those numbers. So the fact that there were initially not hundreds and hundreds of various calculations, and why there are 2 pages of numbers, not 10, in the WMAP analysis is easily explained by this fact.
And just to comment on your question, I mean, the linear term comes from a statistical theorem, and it's unobservable if you have a full sky homogeneous noise, okay. That it becomes proportional to the monocle, which is unobservable. It's still there. It's just that you can't actually implement it. It's only when you break specialized isotropy that you can actually implement and improve the estimator in practice.
Okay, so here's the result. Again, remember, each one of those numbers here and is the result of one of those of a large Monte Carlo study. And some people have been confused by just the format of this plot. As I said, our goal was to analyze the full data set in the least foreground contaminated combination of channels, while, of course, trying to have as much signal as we could in terms of, so V and W are the least foreground contaminated channels, so we combine them together to increase our signal to V plus W. QVW, so the Q channel is actually does show foreground contamination, so we don't include that in the analysis. We just show it because previous analyses did include it in their analysis, which gives a negative bias, actually, in the result, which explains at least partially why earlier analyses were lower than ours. Okay, and then we also break things up into contributions in as a function of Lmax. So the way to interpret this is that if I, so for example, at Lmax of 550,
or actually sorry, 500 here, the anything leftward of, so this contains all of the triangles that have a side of L max of 500 or smaller. Okay. So this number includes all of the triangles that contributed to any of the numbers left to it. So it's just cumulative as we include more triangles. All right. So you would not, so the fact that they're all correlated is completely expected. In fact, you want them to completely saturate as you go up. Some people were confused. They thought, oh, these are, this looks wrong because the error bars are so large and they're all similar. That's exactly expected because they all everything contains all of the information to the left. Okay. Yeah.
I've had people ask about this. Why, when you add the three Q bands, you get a larger error bar?
That's because the estimator is suboptimal. So if you had an optimal estimator, you would not expect that.
So this is not optimal.
But so the beams are different in different channels, and the noise is different in different channels. And so when you combine different channels together, then this trick of just adding a linear term doesn't give you an optimal estimator anymore.
So for one channel, this is optimal, you're saying, but for more than one channel, it's not
right.
Optimal?
Right. I mean, I think the closer the channels are, well, actually, we have more channels. Each one of those, I mean, W is four channels, V is two channels. This is a six-channel combination. But the noise distribution is quite similar. The noise per channel is quite similar. And the beam per channel is quite similar. So that's why it actually reduces the error bar. When you have different beams, then we find that actually the estimator is not optimal, or less optimal. It's never completely optimal. But it becomes less optimal when you have more complicated combinations of channels. All right, so, and as you can see,
the 2 sigma error bar does not overlap 0. So this is the number we quote. OK. And I'm sure there can be a lot. Yeah. OK, so I think that's all I'll say now, because I'll say a lot more in the next few slides. All right, so obviously, since we're claiming a detection at this level of statistical significance, I would say one more thing, which is that this 2 sigma here is in terms of the width of the error bar. But in terms of the null test, if you ask how many sigma away is this point from 0, we get so that's 2.8 sigma, and that translates to the number that you saw in the paper, which was 99.5%, 99.8% significant. Yeah?
L max of 400 and 450, where it's
no. So we've looked at that at some level. We've tried to look at Monte Carlo simulations and sort of look whether this is a generic feature or not. I think it's a little unusual given our Monte Carlo, the sort of set of Monte Carlo simulations, that's just what it is. So the fact is that you are increasing information. The error bar does shrink as you go from here to there, and the value adjusts. So I don't have much more insight into that question.
It's mostly
that
some bands shift one another,
right?
Yeah.
Actually, it's interesting. The V band is actually pretty constant, and W band does seem to shift a bit. Yeah, that's true. And so does the V plus W combination. That's right.
But if there is some non-Gaussianity that just starts being seen at large L's, then that's what you expect from it, right?
Right. So this could be a hint. I mean, this is really a speculation, but if we wanted to, you could see this as a hint, but not a 2 sigma, or maybe a half a sigma hint of scale dependence. Right.
But V doesn't show that. It's only W that shows it.
Right, and the V and plus W combination.
Yeah, that's right. So V is cleaner than W, so.
But I think I will actually argue that so when you say cleaner, you're referring to foreground contamination. I think I can argue relatively strongly that foreground contamination is not a deciding factor here. So I think I'll try to convince you of that in the next few slides. So I think it's more likely that it just there happens to be the noise in the W band just happens to correlate in such a way statistically for that particular realization. But that effect, of course, is included in our Monte Carlo simulations in the error bars. All right, questions you might ask in addition to the ones you've already asked.
The first thought, of course, everyone has is this might be due to an instrument systematic of some kind. Or could it be due to foregrounds? Or could it be due to secondary anisotropies? Or are we just rediscovering some other claim? You know, there are a couple of other claims at the 3 sigma level, or even one is even more than 3 sigma, the cold spot, in the WMAP data. So are we just rediscovering that and is it really not an independent result? And then, you know, it could be a noise fluctuation. So I'll go through in detail in the remaining time. All right. Could this be due to beam asymmetries? Well, so the fact is, and I don't really need to do a calculation for that, but the fact is if the CMB is Gaussian, no asymmetric beam, no asymmetry of the main beam can produce a non-vanishing bispectrum. Okay, that's just because any beam asymmetry would produce a linear combination of the map pixels, basically. And if the pixels are Gaussian, then they have no three-point correlation. Any linear combination of those will also not have any three-point correlation. So, quod erat demonstrandum. All right. There's another possibility that large side lobes could spread around non-Gaussian features in the sky, which are there. I mean, there is a large galaxy that we have to deal with. So if large side lobes that are away from the main beam of WMAP somehow spread a small amount of that contribution over the sky, could this be causing our result? All right. So these are large side lobes. So that means they smooth the contribution quite a lot. And in the first year analysis of WMAP, they looked actually at the kind of contribution this produces. And it turns out it's basically localized to L less than 10, 10 or less. Okay. So it's unlikely to affect the high L regime. And the change in our result is because we pushed to higher L because of the improved estimator. Okay. Further, this is still foreground. So we should see frequency dependence, which we don't see at the L's, at the high L's where we calculate. Yes?
I'm looking for F and L, and you're not really looking at high L. You have more data.
Yes,
L,
that's correct.
You're looking at squeezed triangles.
Sorry.
And this actually no longer
yeah.
Age of triangles.
Yes, two more points I want to make. So can I make those 2 points? And then
okay.
So the third point is, the WMAP team actually corrected for this large sort of steering effect of side lobes. But large in the sense, large scale. It's actually a small effect. It's less than a microkelvin. But it was corrected in the third year data. So it's actually a smaller level even than in the first year data. I don't know what the residual is actually. But it's less than 1 microkelvin. I don't think it says anywhere in the WMAP publications exactly what the residual is after correcting for this effect. I looked for it and didn't find it. However, if the fourth thing I would say is that we actually, and I'll show you the number in a minute, when we tested whether this was due to a large-scale anisotropy, one of the claims is that there's a large-scale weirdness in the WMAP data somehow. I don't believe that personally, but there's some people who believe that. We actually reanalyzed everything, throwing out L max of 20 or less.
L min, so raising the minimum L up to 21. Okay, that increases the central value of our result. It also increases the error bar. And if you want to take that and just ignore anything at L of 20 or less, you get a 2.3 sigma result, something like that. So 2.3, I don't remember the exact number, but I'll show it to you in a minute. So, but the tendency is to raise it. Rather than lower it. And I'll also argue that in general, foregrounds, large scale foregrounds, will give you a negative bias. So all of these arguments suggest that if this is there, then it would negatively bias it. But it's very small, and there's no evidence that this has any effect. Yeah.
That has been corrected only Kera.
No, that's not true. That's in the first year.
That's possible.
In the third year data.
Ben, this might be a stretch, but the first point up there, asymmetry. So, but your maps are mildly non-Gaussian, right? Because of foregrounds, point sources.
Mm-hmm.
If you had a beam asymmetry, can you actually enhance that non-Gaussianity and detect a large NFL?
So this is kind of a second order effect on secondary and
astrophysics. No, I'm not. No.
And so I'm wondering what this says. I mean, and I'll look at secondary as an example.
Does it, I know, I'm just saying if you had like a galactic foreground or something.
So we mask the galactic foreground. So.
No, but
it has to be more important on small scales, right?
Sorry?
It has to be more important on small scales.
If it's a beam asymmetry.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, to the extent that that would be a modif- so I think the argument basically, this is the argument about, I think the 5 points I made is that foregrounds, looking at foregrounds through the side lobes is extremely unlikely to be the source of this effect. And if it is, it would be negative, it would give you a negative bias. You're saying, what about secondary?
No, I'm just saying foregrounds, actually.
Even other foregrounds.
So if you image them with the asymmetric beam, can you localize some non-Gaussian energy to a certain scale of the probably not.
I'm surprised.
Yeah. So it still would be frequency dependent.
It should still be frequency dependent. Okay. I mean, I think the set of arguments I gave, some of those apply to the question. All right, so that was beam asymmetries. What about other possible instrument systematics? So WMAP noise, could it be some feature in the noise model? Okay, we actually, our Monte Carlos do not include noise correlations, and there are noise correlations at an extremely small level in the WMAP data. So again, because as long as the noise is Gaussian, it can be as correlated as you like, there's never going to, we'll never produce a bispectrum. Noise correlations might affect the variance on the estimator, but actually, we're doing studies in the context of Planck, and even for Planck, which is more correlated than WMAP, this is a completely negligible effect. So, as long as the noise is Gaussian, no noise correlation will produce bias. And the variance is also not going to be enhanced given these studies. Okay, so what about non-Gaussian noise? Yes, non-Gaussian noise could produce this in principle. Okay? If you had some kind of non-Gaussian noise or some instrument systematic that looks non-Gaussian. So one way to look at that is to actually take the WMAP yearly maps and look at subsequent years. You can actually generate sort of artificial but real, I mean, from the real WMAP data, you can generate noise-only maps that contain all of these effects. So when we do that and subtract these years, we actually get FNL values of 1.1, 1.8, and minus 3.4. So I think an extremely conservative estimate of the effect of the contribution due to this is, one sigma systematic error would be plus minus one or two. This is basically the estimate. Right. This plus minus 60 is actually including cosmic variance. The fact that these are all much, much less than 60 is because these are noise-only maps. They don't include cosmic variance. All right, so this is not dominant. Whatever it does, it's not the source of the effect. And it's probably zero. Okay, so if you really wanted to explain this effect in terms of an instrumental systematic,
it would have to be A, non-Gaussian, B, the same, exact same, in individual years so that it doesn't appear in these difference maps. And three, it would have to mimic the specific bispectrum signature of FNL that I showed you before, with oscillations in L space and the particular bispectrum fingerprint of squeezed triangles and all the rest of it. So again, I would argue that this is extremely unlikely to be the source of our result. Okay, so what about foregrounds? And we've already discussed foregrounds to some extent here, different foreground masks. This is the most aggressive mask, less aggressive mask, most conservative WMAP mask up until this point, up until 2 days ago. And this is a more conservative mask that we've made based on basically extending this mask and smoothing it, which actually does, this mask looks relatively similar actually to the most aggressive current WMAP mask. Okay, so what happens? This is actually this is the KP2 mask, and here are the numbers that we get. The summary is that the V and W channels are the least foreground contaminated. Our choice of V plus W is driven by foreground considerations, and we analyze the raw maps that include foregrounds. We don't try to subtract the foregrounds, because if we over-subtracted the foregrounds, we might generate spurious signal. And what we also show is when we look in this in the foreground dominated regime, okay, for this very small mask, we find extremely negative results. Then as we go to the next mask, we still find negative results. When we go to this mask, the conservative mask, we find these results. And then as we increase the mask even more, we find essentially the same results. So increasing the mask increases the error bar. And since we find the same results in these two masks for any of the interesting LMAX, this is consistent with just a large error bar because this includes only up to LMAX up to 350. We choose to take this value as a conservative estimate because if there's any foreground contamination, we would expect it to be negative. Yes?
Between the mask and the data, because you're using the data itself to construct the mask. So are there just correlations to intrinsic CMB fluctuations, or I mean, even if you mask, you have point source mask from NVSS, that's still going to have correlations with features in the CMB data.
We didn't look at that. We didn't look at correlations between the mask and data.
I have an answer to that question.
Aisha has a footnote in his in the.
I have addressed both of the questions, so I'll get back.
Okay.
I'll talk about that.
So the newest topic that I've followed, I don't want to speak to Aisha's talk, but since the mask was defined in a different way in the 5U data, that may answer. Okay. And then if you look at the frequency dependence between these different colors correspond to different frequency, there's no significant frequency dependence given the error bar. That would lead us to conclude that foregrounds are not dominant for this. So here's a more detailed, this is another argument that foregrounds would actually lead to negative FNL. Large scale skewness in the temperature map corresponds to negative FNL. You saw that these filters are actually negative on large scales.
These added L modes from 450 to 550 also actually give negative, this filter is actually negative there. But that's not the most important point. We have actually done a fairly detailed analysis now. When we take foreground subtracted maps and redo the analysis, we actually get more similar results in the more aggressive masks. So the subtracting the foreground model actually raises FNL up, is what I'm trying to say. And that's true for all of the cases. So actually, we get FNL of 95 or something like that if we try to subtract foregrounds. We don't quote these numbers because by subtracting the foreground masks, we might be over-subtracting the foregrounds and artificially enhancing our FNL. Like this, we're on the safe side. We know that foregrounds will reduce FNL average. To prove that to ourselves, we actually did Monte Carlo simulations of Gaussian CMB with primordial FNL of 0, including a foreground model, which includes pre-free, synchrotron, and dust, and simulated WMAP noise. And here's what we get for the average FNL for these different masks, including all of the WMAP data. It goes from essentially very similar numbers to what we saw in the real data, minus 1,000 or so, minus 40, minus 6, and 0. So this is the number we quote, because minus 6 is a lot smaller than our error bar. But if we did correct for it, we would push up the result by about 6. And it's consistent for the 0 for masks greater than KP0. The Monte Carlo error in this number is plus or minus 2, something like 2.5. So you could say it's consistent with 0 or small negative bias. Okay, so I think I hope to have convinced you that foregrounds, large-scale and diffuse galactic foregrounds, would actually depress the result rather than enhance it artificially. Okay, what about secondary anisotropies? Well, so point sources are expected to be a very small contribution of order 1 or so. Actually, if SZ is also for WMAP, SZ is really like point sources because it's just negative, so they would actually have opposite signs and tend to cancel each other. If you just look, this is the, and because the bispectrum signature really is very different from FNL, we showed in KSW and in the first and third year WMAP analysis, Ichiro showed, in other papers, and Ichiro also showed in Komatsu's Svergel, and then there's this paper, very nice paper by Sarah and Kure, where it was also shown that this contribution is there's basically no confusion from point sources when it comes at the L's that we're talking about at the level of signal-to-noise and WMAP data. Okay, so but there are other contributions that are more important, namely the ISW lensing bispectrum and the SC lensing bispectrum. This one was discussed earlier also by Chuyo and David Spergel. And they also have opposite signs, and the estimate is that they would, if FNL were 20, this would give you an effective bias of about 2 or so, or a few. It would have a negligible effect for FNL larger than 20 in terms of the extra error bar that you should add, because the error bar adds in quadrature. So if FNL were 20, this would be about a 10% effect. At the FNLs that we're talking about, around 80, this is a very small effect.
And the error bar really doesn't get
larger by this, because the error bar, if you compute that, it actually adds in quadrature. Are we just looking at another non-Gaussian signal? There are a number of them. I can easily argue that it's not. So here's a three sigma claim. This is a much smaller angular scale. This is the claim that hot and cold spots in the first year WMAP data were not hot and cold enough. This is a much smaller angular scales. Also, it was a symmetric result. And it's probably the noise model. We actually never claimed that this was primordial. There's a big disclaimer in this paper saying this is a very small scale. We're looking basically probing the noise model. And the gain model didn't adjust in the third-year data. We haven't reproduced these results for the three-year data. So it's certainly not that. Anyway, so then there is a large a claim detection at large significance, which is the cold spot in Vielva et al., 2004. This is localized in the map and covers a particular range in scale. So we actually subtract this off, we mask that region, and redo our analysis. The result goes up. Okay, and basically the error bar is also about 30 actually still, and so I mean it's only a small fraction of the sky that you mask, and so really this actually increases the significance of the result, but we don't correct for that, so because we just take this as justification for leaving it in there, and if it is in there. I mean, if we were to take it out, it would just increase the significance of the result. All right. What about large-scale anomalies? Well, we can just analyze the data excluding any information at L of 20 or less. And that actually raises up the numbers. And it also increases the error bar significantly. But actually still, I don't remember off the top of my head what this, how many sigma this is, but I think it's roughly 2.5 sigma. So it still gives you 2.5 sigma result, even when you throw away any, and this would include any beam side lobe effects. Yes.
To do FNL means more cold spots, right?
I don't think that's true. it's more complicated than that because it depends on the scales. Because of this oscillating effect, it actually depends on what scale you're talking about.
A larger scale.
Though. I think on large scales, that's true.
Yeah. Okay, so the cold spot is a large scale feature, right? And it's extremely non-Gaussian.
It's like 5-degree feature. Actually.
And it is non-Gaussian in the map. I mean,
yeah, right. That's right.
So but why does the FNL go up if you remove it?
It does. I don't know. It just does. I mean, it's true. I mean, I especially expected it to go. That's why we looked at this, because it was negative. So there are a couple of points one should make about this. First of all, the cold spot was not detected in terms of skewness. It was detected in terms of kurtosis, right? So that's one fact one can say. The other thing is it's a localized feature. So just because there's a localized feature that happens to be negative does not mean that that would bias FNL. The FNL of the local type comes from a correlation of small-scale and large-scale features. And so if the correlations just work out and with other negative features somewhere else, small-scale features, this could very well give you a positive contribution. So I didn't look at that in that much detail. Just wanted to do the test and convince people that this we're not seeing a cold spot. Any other questions about any of this? Okay. So could it be a noise fluctuation? Yes, it's possible. It is we claim 2.8 sigma for a hypothesis test.
So at that level, if you have a 1 in 100 chance of it being a noise fluctuation, okay, less than 1 in 100 actually, it's 1 in 200 or so. If we increase the error bar artificially to 35 to include a contribution from possible non-Gaussian based on the three yearly difference maps, there could be a possible non-Gaussian contribution from that, including point source non-Gaussian error bar, increasing that and increasing the error bar due to systematic effects. So we just add 5 to the error bar. This goes down to a 2.5 sigma result, which I would claim is pretty conservative. One thing I didn't describe here was we also checked for the sensitivity of this to the cosmological parameters we use in the analysis. Okay, we use a scalar spectral index of 1 because that is how we calibrated the estimator. We actually did Monte Carlo simulations of non-Gaussian maps, made sure for ns equals to 1, made sure that we got back what we put in. This is why we used that estimator in that same code, which was validated on these simulations to do the analysis. Okay, but that's not the WMAP best fit value, which is more like 0.95, slightly larger. When we vary that, actually our result changes very little. At Lmax of 750, it goes down a little bit, but the error bar shrinks even more. So actually, if you do that, you get a 3 sigma result. But at lower L, it goes down a bit more, so it goes from 80 to 70, basically. But the error bar also shrinks to about 27 or so. So I think any way you play this, you get a between 2.5 and 3 sigma result. If you correct for the negative foreground bias and use the best fit WMAP parameters, including all of the data, and you push everything in the direction of wanting to make it as large an effect as possible, it will be 3.3 sigma. Okay. I think this sort of bounds the region, and this is and our initial estimate of 2.8 sigma, 99.8% significance, is right in the middle of that. And actually, I should also say that we updated the paper 2 days ago, 3 days ago, on the archive. So you can look at all of these numbers are now in there too, and a few more. Okay, so that concludes the discussion of our result. I just want to say a few more words about non-Gaussianity post WMAP. Here's the plot I promised earlier, Alicia, about what happens when you just go up to higher and higher Lmax. This is the Fisher matrix. This is from temperature and depolarization and combined. What's interesting for Planck is that even with Planck, just from polarization alone, you should be able to get an FNL estimate at roughly the same level or even slightly better than the 3-year WMAP analysis. So you can actually do the analysis with polarization data and temperature data separately and make sure that you get the same thing. They probe different scales, so that's very interesting. The combined analysis gives you an FNL, should give you an error bar of about, it says 3 in the Krummerau bound. Both people say 5 just because then you have to work much harder to get rid of secondary effects and foregrounds and so forth. The analysis is really limited by how well you can subtract or take into account. Because of the added signal to noise in Planck, you need to take into account a lot more effects. That was one signal. Yeah. Okay, so the summary is that delta FNL is about 30 for if you include all of the WMAP 3-year data using our the Yadav Matsuvandert estimator this is ns equal to 1. If you use the WMAP best fit parameters, it's more like 27. But we still quoted the ns equals to 1 result just because we want to be slightly conservative. This is the first bispectrum-based analysis of the full WMAP 3-year data. This is the first significant departure claimed for FNL from 0. The FNL being different from 0 at larger than 99% confidence. The estimator is tested against Gaussian and non-Gaussian simulations with and without imaginary noise, and we find that it's unbiased. And if there were any bias in the foregrounds, it's likely to be negative. So in terms of foreground error bar, the guess is that at sort of 1 sigma is at 0 plus 5. I don't really see how foregrounds could make this reduce the size of the result, but it could enlarge. But if you corrected for it, it would enlarge it slightly. And these detailed tests back up the analysis and arguments that we had in our first version of the paper, and the second version that includes all of this is now out online. So the conclusion from this is that if our result holds up to scrutiny and the statistical weight of future data, because it is a 2.5 to 3 sigma result, we conclude that the single field, that single field slow roll inflation is disfavored by the WMAP data. And in terms of the outlook, you'll hear in a moment about WMAP 5-year data. 8-year data could give us an even better constraint. From Planck, in about 5 years, we should get data FNL of around 5. That allows cross-checks using temperature and polarization data. FNL is complementary to tensor modes as a way of distinguishing between classes of models that give similar predictions for two-point correlations. So FNL, it's a non-Gaussian, it is a new frontier where you can learn a lot more about the physics of the early universe. And I think overall, this is great news for very early universe cosmology. So thank you very much for bearing with me through this detailed analysis. That's the end of my talk. Thank you.
Yeah, so if I ask the question, if this is real, then how do I know it's actually really local, other than some rather crazy form that somehow spills to the local form? So one way I could imagine testing for this, I don't know if it's realistic, but would be to somehow deform your estimator and to see if the change in the significance of the detection is consistent with a purely local. Is that something that's easy to do, or is that very easy?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you want to test. I mean, the idea here is that this is a physically motivated test because there are models that actually produce FNL of this type. So we look for that particular type. But, you know, there is a conflicting desire to somehow be model independent, right? So you could, and that's, there's a whole field of people doing non-Gaussianity analysis, which don't try to define best fit estimators for any particular model, but just look for weirdness in the data. What you're suggesting is kind of in the middle, where you're saying, you know, to what extent can I have to say something generic? So I think the best strategy is probably to just work out for different models. I mean, I like the fact that FNL is motivated physically, and I don't have to argue, you know, why did you look at pixel 527,465?
No, I understand. So, but I don't mean something completely generic. I mean, for example, if I remember Dan's analysis properly, you know, they show the shape as a function, you know, the amplitude as a function of different triangles, and you could say, well, let me pick an estimator that for their shape, it's about half the signal I expect, and then you check that FNL. I don't know. Just something.
So you could, so in some sense, I'm not sure, I think we'll talk about this later, the Minkowski functionals is something like that. Minkowski functionals are not tuned to be perfectly, an opportunity to be the best estimator for local FNL, but you can take combinations of them that isolate that contribution, but there are also contributions from other triangles. So in principle, what you would like to do is compute all of the triangles and just look at what happens when you weight them. In practice, that is difficult just because there are L cubed triangles. Each triangle takes, each combination takes L squared operations to compute, which is L to the 5. For, you know, L is around 1,000 here, and that's just a lot of computation.
Plus each triangle has signal to noise 10 to the minus 3.
So. Yes, so that's the other thing. I mean, at this point, I mean, you know, yes, I'd love to look for scale dependence, but at this point, the data just doesn't, that doesn't warrant that, the level of signal to noise.
Gagan. I'm not sure if you discussed this already, but so at least version one of your paper, you pick up your result at L of 400 and higher, roughly where the experiment becomes noise dominated. Are you concerned about that?
So the noise is something, I mean, we do include the noise in our Monte Carlo simulations. So if it were an effect, and we did discuss this earlier a little bit, if the noise were just, that particular noise realization just happened to align with the signal, then you do get, that does produce, you know, the contribution to the variance, but that is included in our error bars. You know? So if that noise contribution were at the 3 sigma level, then that would explain this result. So, yeah, but it has to be at the 3 sigma level for that.
What could produce non-Gaussian instrument noise?
The WMAP instrument is a beautiful instrument. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it really, they worked extremely hard to make it not have non-Gaussian noise. Right? You could imagine differential heating from different solar radiation angles. I don't build CFD satellites, so I'm not qualified to answer that in detail. But there are many effects that need to be controlled. So I don't think this is there. We just wanted to check for it so I could show the numbers and say this is very unlikely to do this.
So I guess a related question is there any possibility that WMAP instrument itself is nonlinear in the signal in some way?
I asked my instrumental colleagues this. They say WMAP is extremely linear in the distribution. So that really does not seem to be a concern. It's partly related to the Gaussianity of the noise, which is also demonstrated very badly.
So is there predicted L dependence for any of these models in FNL?
The slow roll inflation model predicts a scale dependent non-Gaussianity, but at a much lower level than this. So.
But you're going to have talks on that, actually.
So there are lots of talks. Sorry, I don't want to get everybody else's talk. I'm not qualified to do that. And actually, part of the question about whether this is the noise or not can be analyzed with more data. And unless there are urgent questions right now, I'd be happy to entertain. I would say let's hear about the most recent results.